Today, answers matter more than ever before. That's why IBM is helping businesses manage customer questions with Watson Assistant. It's conversational AI designed to work for any industry. Let's put smart to work. Visit ibm.com/Watson Assistant.
710 ESPN presents The Experience with LaFern Cusack, where we go beyond the play and focus on athletes, fans, events, and the biggest issues that inspire and shape our lives. Here's the host of The Experience, LaFern Cusack.
I'm speaking with Dr. Eric Presser. He's a leading thoracic surgeon specializing in minimally invasive surgery and also an author of a great book called An Empowering Guide to Lung Cancer, 6 Steps to Taking Charge of Your Care and Your Life. And you can get that on Amazon. He shares valuable insights that help patients educate themselves so they can confidently participate in the decision of their care and treatment. Did you know that lung cancer is the number one cancer killer in our world today? It kills more than 1.6 million people every year. And one major misconception is that lung cancer is a self-inflicted disease, resulting only from abuse to the body through behaviors like smoking. And there's a thing called third-hand smoke. So Dr. Presser is going to take us through all of that today. He's going to take the myths out of lung cancer and misinformation to help you take charge of your health and your life. I'm LaFern Cusack. This is 710 ESPN.
Experience never stops. Never stops. On your station, 710 ESPN. Here's LaFern Cusack.
Dr. Eric Presser, what led you to want to be a thoracic surgeon?
When I was a sophomore in college, I got a call from my father who told me that he was going on a business trip to Germany. And I found out that it was a lie. He actually went in and had open heart surgery. And he never gave me the opportunity to experience what he went through before the operation. And I actually was at University of Florida and I hopped on the next plane. My mom threw me the car keys. I drove into the city and the mix of emotions was overwhelming because to see, you know, someone that you love who's so big and strong and powerful, look so vulnerable, I was so happy that he was alive, but I was also very angry that he never gave me the opportunity to share with him in the experience. And in the book that I wrote, I actually tell that story and I tell it so that people understand that their support system and their family needs to know, needs to be given the option of how to help, how to support, how to love, how to handle things. Because a lot of times patients, unfortunately, they think they're doing their loved ones a favor by keeping things from them. And it's actually the complete opposite. So once that happened, I became a little more involved and interested in medicine. And once I, you know, got into medical school, I saw that I was pretty good with my hands and I played sports my whole life and I just, you know, fit in with the surgeons. And once you actually see the inside of a chest, you know that it's the center of the universe. And I knew there was nothing else that I wanted to do for the rest of my life.
So what happened to your dad?
So he did fine afterwards. He, you know, got out of the hospital and this is now, God, 30 years ago. And he recovered from the surgery. He was never really the same, but at least, you know, his heart was working well. Unfortunately, he's not with us anymore today. He died at a young age from other causes, but it was kind of like a turning point in my life where I was so intrigued by the surgeons who could actually, you know, fix a human being and give them life, that I was hopeful that I would be able to do something like that with my career. And here I am today.
Yeah, making miracles, right? So you chose this profession. It was very personal for you. Tell us, like, you had to have the passion, of course, to get into this industry and save lives. How much schooling did you have to have? And
sure. A lot. You know, one of the things I tell people or young adults, I have a 13-year-old son, I tell them, don't ever let anyone tell you you can't do something. It sounds very cliche, but the truth is that I'm originally from New York. I went to school in University of Florida, and my grades were pretty good, but I always had to work to prove that I was as good, if not better, than the guy next to me to get to the next step. Mm-hmm. If you look back on my resume, I ended up doing my residency at St. Vincent's Hospital in New York City. I then went on to do fellowship in LSU and University of Texas. But I actually went to a foreign medical school, and I was treated like a foreign medical graduate, and I had to work that much harder and just prove myself along the way. Never got upset, never got angry. Just kept grinding, just kept doing everything that I wanted to do to try to reach my goal. And that's the best advice that I can give anybody, is just don't let anyone tell you you can't do something. Because when I was in college and I went to my guidance counselors, they told me I should never even try to become a physician. And I'm the first physician in my family. It's not like I come from a long line of physicians. So once I did get into medical school and I did well on those tests and I decided I wanted to be a surgeon, well, becoming a cardiothoracic surgeon is hard enough. And now what I do, I actually subspecialize in minimally invasive thoracic only, which means I chose, I don't do heart surgery. I do everything else in the chest, but hearts is how I describe it to people.
Oh.
And I use very small incisions and minimally invasive techniques, which there really aren't too many of us that consistently do it throughout the country and throughout the world.
So my father, he died of the valve.
Sure.
This was how it was described to me. You breathe in, and then the valve goes.
Correct. It's like a gasket on a car. I mean, that's, yes, I'm trained in how to fix those. And in my training, I fixed many of those valves. And essentially, the valves are there to help the blood go forward and not come back. And when they're blown apart, if you will, the blood goes forward, it comes back, it just messes everything up. I mean, we're technically a bunch of pipes. And if the pipes are broken and they don't work well, everything gets messed up and backed up, and it causes a lot of problems. And it's amazing, actually, what we can do nowadays. The operations that I perform through very small incisions, mm-hmm. I do them so that the patient has less stress on their body, less pain, less time in the hospital. And it's something that I actually firsthand saw when I was training at St. Vincent's in New York. It was back when there was a lot of AIDS and HIV patients. And a lot of those patients have lung disease. And we had to take biopsies or take pieces of the lung tissue out, and we had to make them through big incisions. Now, big incisions in the chest hurt. So a lot of these patients who were already fighting these underlying lung disease and lung illness, now they were on the ventilator with a large incision. It just made it much more difficult. So you're always asking yourself, what can I do to make things better, or how can I be less invasive? That's why whenever I talk to people or I'm at parties and they ask me, you know, my opinion or questions, any kind of surgery, it's not just chest surgery, any kind of surgery, you really want to educate yourself on not just what the surgeon is going to do to you, but what are the options on how it can be done, how it can be fixed. Because a lot of times people are sent to doctors only because that's who they know. That's the network that they use. And there's nothing wrong with getting a second opinion. We can have a whole conversation about healthcare, but that's a whole different topic. But the truth is that if you're going to advocate for yourself or your family members, you really want to know what's going on. And that's why in my book, I have topics on educating yourself, just knowing what your options are, not just for lung masses or lung cancer, but any kind of cancer, any kind of surgery, whether you're going for your gallbladder, you're going for a hernia operation, you really want to know what you're getting yourself into. And you really want to know the surgeon who's going to have the privilege of cutting into you. And that's the way I look at it. Whenever I meet someone for the first time and I earn their respect and they tell me that they feel comfortable with me enough to actually cut into their body, to me, that's a privilege. Right. And it makes me feel, you know, warm and fuzzy inside. And when everything goes well, there's nothing like it on the planet, to be honest with you. As corny as that sounds.
No, I love it. And I love how you put it. So when my father was going through this, it was like he went in and got a stent put in, right?
Sure.
And it was like he was home the next day. And I'm like, why are they just pushing him out of the hospital? But for you to say, you know, you want them out of the hospital so they can go on living in a productive way. I always thought it was about insurance or something, like, you know, but
no, there's certain times to keep people in the hospital. And there are other times when you really don't want them in the hospital. Hospital is a place where you can actually catch, you know, disease, you know, and it's a place where you're not at home in your own bed. You're not, you know, eating your own home cooked meals. You know, your home is your home for most people.
Mm-hmm.
And when people are getting you out of the hospital nowadays, it's not usually for insurance reasons. It's because it's the best thing to do. I mean, we all have a common goal, and that's to help as many people as we can and get them back to their normal routine.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's very scary. For example, what I do when someone comes into my office and they have, you know, a mass in their lung, no diagnosis, what do we do? And so one of the things I always lecture to the residents and to other physicians is that you really have to make sure that everyone understands the plan. To be a good surgeon, you have to have a good plan and you have to be able to execute. A lot of people might have a good plan, but they just can't execute. Okay. I mean, surgery is difficult to do. If my father used to tell me that if it was easy, anyone could do it, right? So you have to have a good plan. You have to be able to execute. And when someone's in your office, whether they're by themselves or with family members, you have to make sure that everyone in the room understands what's going on, because I do this every day and they do this once. And that's what I always tell them. Ask questions. If a physician ever wants to answer your questions, it's because either they're too arrogant or they just don't know the answer.
Yeah.
And that's the truth.
Wow. Well, that's empowering. So it's... My friend had lung cancer, and it's a name, it's kind of like squish.
Squamous cell?
Yes, yes, exactly.
Okay. Yes.
First of all, I had to Google it,
right.
And I read that it's a fast-spreading cancer.
I wrote my book because I wanted to increase awareness about lung cancer.
Right.
Lung cancer is the number one cancer killer in the United States and in the world. We know that 1 in 6 smokers will get lung cancer. We know the direct correlation with smoking. What a lot of people don't understand is that 15% of lung cancer patients are never smokers. Okay? That's amazing. It's also scary. If I told you you had a 15% chance of winning the lottery, you'd be playing every weekend.
Right.
If I told you get 15% yield on your money, you would put it right into that investment.
There I am.
Okay?
Right.
So starting with lung cancer, when you have 15% that are never smokers, and you know that people that smoke have increased risk, you have to now ask yourself, how do we catch it early? Because everyone knows about screening for colon cancer, screening for breast cancer, screening for prostate cancer. The studies that led up to obtaining a CAT scan of the chest yearly, if you are between the ages of 55 and 77, you are asymptomatic, you smoked a pack of cigarettes a day for 30 years or 2 packs for 15 years, you are an active smoker, or you quit within the last 15 years. Okay. Those are the guidelines. Those are the CMS, the Center for Medicare and Medicaid Services guidelines on who should get a CAT scan of the chest for screening so that we can catch these little nodules, these little cancers early where we have an option of resecting for cure. That's the bottom line. Now, it doesn't mean that every spot or every mass that you find on a CAT scan is a cancer. Quite the opposite. But we have the opportunity nowadays to find these early. And once again, this is only in the high-risk group. I just told you that 15% of never smokers get lung cancer. So we're kind of in the baby steps of how do we figure out what's going on? How do we catch this killer, this number one killer? How do we catch it early? Well, we have to start with the high-risk group, and then we have to work our way to figuring out how we can catch everybody.
Right.
One of the problems we have now is that there's a lack of funding compared to other cancers. It's just a fact. Lung cancer doesn't get much attention because most people think it's a smoker's disease. They think that, well, they must have smoked. It's their fault. Put them over there. They're going to die anyway. And now people are realizing that's not the case. So I wrote my book not just to help awareness, but also to help educate people on not just lung cancer. There are sections in my book that you can go to if you have a family member with breast cancer, and you can read about how to handle their chemotherapy treatments, how to handle their emotional journey. You know, it touches upon, you know, everything from exercise to nutritional supplements. I have people that come in to me all the time and ask me about that. I mean, your show is on health and wellness. Well, the number one reason why people go into the emergency room is because they can't breathe. Lung health is a huge topic right now with what's been going on throughout the world.
Yeah.
I mean, we can sit and talk about, you know, COVID all day, but the truth is that it falls under the category of lung health.
Oh, right.
For the most part.
Right.
And so we're talking about as a thoracic surgeon, I love and try to find lung cancers early so we can cut them out. But more importantly, you have to know what the options are. The guidelines I just gave you were between the ages of 55 and 77, but I work here in Palm Springs, California, and I can tell you that I see 80 plus, you know, people that are 80 plus years old who look better than most people in the country.
Mm-hmm.
They take great care of themselves. They golf three times a week. They exercise three times a week. They're swimming. They're fantastic. And there's no reason why they shouldn't be a surgical candidate if that's what an option is. And then there are other people that probably can't tolerate a haircut, let alone an operation. And you have to know what those options are.
Right, right.
So it's nothing is black and white. And that's where talking to your patients, you know, getting a feel for what they want, what they understand, what their goals of care are. It's very important. Just because you put on a white coat doesn't mean you know how to talk to people.
Exactly. And that was the thing, like, especially like with my father and my mother, sometimes you didn't know what to ask. Like, and to have an empowering guide to lung cancer, six steps to taking charge of your care and your life. I love how now I feel people are stepping up to accountability for themselves and asking more and more questions. How do you describe a person who doesn't know exactly what to ask because it's new to them?
One of the things I would tell them is go buy my book. But yeah. The truth is that anyone nowadays can just pick up their phone, and it's amazing what questions you can ask. I mean, you can go and, you know, say, what questions do I ask when I go to my doctor about, you know, a lung mass? And a whole bunch of questions will pop up. I mean, I have a bunch of videos that I've done on YouTube, and I do them to help educate people on different topics. I mean, as a minimally invasive thoracic surgeon, I do operations to help people stop sweating. you know, 2% of the population is affected by what's called hyperhidrosis, where they have socially debilitating sweating, where they can't go and shake hands, or, you know, their armpits, they sweat through shirts. And, you know, there are procedures that we can do to help that. So going back and answering, you know, your question, it's really about education. And we have so much at our fingertips now that you can be prepared as if you're going in for a job interview. And once again, the physician, my job, as busy as I might be, is still to treat every patient as if they're my only patient. And that's what makes a good doctor. I mean, there's not going to be, you know, not everyone's a good doctor. Not right. Everyone's a good communicator. But that's why people have the right in this country to make choices. And sometimes people tell me, you know, I really don't like this doctor. And I say, well, you know, go try to find another one if you can, because they're the ones who have to make you feel comfortable and answer your questions to a reasonable degree. I mean, we all know that, you know, some patients have expectations that are, you know, out of control, but for the most part, you can tell in the first 15 seconds of a conversation what someone is feeling, what they're thinking, you know, how scared they are, how in tune they are, you know, are they going to understand what you're saying to them? You know, you never want to be condescending, but you also have to know your audience. That's really important. So I think that nowadays, you're correct, people are becoming more and more, they're advocating for themselves. How many times has your mother or father gone to the doctor and you say, how'd it go? And they come back and they say, well, they gave me these two prescriptions. And you say, well, what are they for? And you go, I don't know. I'm just going to fill them. And I think that's a generational thing where a lot of, you know, people, you know, past generations, they trust. They say, oh, the doctor said this, I'm going to go do it. And I think nowadays a lot more people are asking questions. And I encourage people to ask me questions, because if they don't leave my office understanding what my thought process is and understanding the plan, then I'm not doing my job.
So for the lung cancer that my friend had, he died like rather quickly. It was like within 3 months.
So going back to finding this early, unfortunately, we're only finding about 15% of lung cancers in the early stages. Usually by the time you have symptoms, whether it's cough, shortness of breath, chest pain, coughing up blood, it's already too far gone. It means that it's already in the later stages. Our body is so resilient that if I told you that you have a 1 centimeter tumor in your chest right now, it's not going to cause any symptoms for the most part. It depends on where it's located, but for the most part, it's not going to cause any symptoms. And that's just because our body, you know, handles stress until it cannot do that anymore.
Right.
And so your friend most likely was fine. And then all of a sudden had, you know, a cough and some shortness of breath, maybe had a little bit of weight loss, just didn't feel right. And then what happens is goes in, gets checked out. And next thing you know, they're diagnosed with, you know, stage 4 cancer. And everyone says, oh, my God. But meanwhile, it's been going on for a while. It just didn't show the signs and symptoms. And that's one of the reasons why the 5-year survival rate for lung cancer is so low. It's because we're finding that people have these cancers, have these lung cancers when they're in the later stages. And the only option at that time is chemotherapy with or without radiation therapy. And it's really only to prolong life, if you will. Sometimes it's only months.
What would you say to your patients that have to go through chemotherapy, not knowing what to expect?
Great question, because everyone's different. And so what I tell everybody that I diagnose with cancer is that everything is treatable, not necessarily curable, because when we're talking about early stage lung cancers that I can cut out for cure, I'm telling them I'm cutting this out for cure. The patients that are in the later stages, like we're talking about, you tell them everyone is going to respond to treatment differently. And a lot of patients come and say, well, my friend down the block went through chemo. It was the worst experience of their life. Not only did they lose their hair, they were nauseous. They had all the side effects. And what I tell them is that everyone is different. And the one thing about chemotherapy that a lot of people might not understand is that you can stop it. You can try it. You can see how you handle it. And then you can stop if it's really making you miserable. And that's really important. It's really important for patients to understand that. Now, I'm not the oncologist. I'm not the cancer specialist who's giving the chemotherapy. But I see what it does to patients. Some patients say they have no side effects and it's fine. And other patients, like I said, it's debilitating and it's not worth it for them to go through. But when you're faced with that decision where someone tells you, if we don't do this, you're going to die quicker, I hope that's a situation that I'm never placed or put into.
Yeah.
But all you can do is be supportive of your patients and their decisions.
What do you say with people? You're talking about, you know, the pills that you take, and then also there are some other forms of therapy. A lot of people, like, for instance, like, I don't like to take a lot of pills. I don't, my body doesn't do well with pills. So, for instance, I took Vicodin and I was up for 3 days and I can never take Vicodin again, right? So, what about the holistic side, combining the two medicines? Is that something that you do?
So, I don't personally prescribe holistic pills or supplements, but I am a big fan of never taking away hope from anybody. And the reason why I say that with such conviction is because we know what the science is. We are evolving every day. There's new treatments that are coming out. And once again, to reiterate, the treatment for lung cancer is contingent and based upon the stage. The earlier stages, we can cut out for cure. And as it progresses, your options are limited. When you are dealing with chemotherapy, radiation therapy, and someone says, take this turmeric oil, or, you know, take this, you know, supplement, I'm never going to tell them no. I'm never going to tell them that's a waste of your time. Don't do it. Because I'm a true believer that if you have hope and you are positive, no one can take that away from you. It's one of those things where it cannot hurt.
Yeah.
Because I get asked that question all the time. There's 1,000 articles out there. You know, should I cut out sugar because sugar feeds cancer? And I mean, should I stop drinking coffee and all these things? And the truth is that nothing is set in stone. Nothing is black and white. You have to make yourself feel as good as you can, because a lot of times these patients that are undergoing treatment like chemotherapy or radiation therapy, you want them to be as medically optimized as possible, but you also want them emotionally optimized.
Right. So you talked about COVID. Can you explain it? Can you explain it to me in layman's terms? Is it really eating your lungs?
So the truth right now about COVID is there's a lot of unanswered questions. And I'm not going to sit here and pretend to know all the answers, because I've read the same articles that everyone else has. And I can tell you, as a thoracic surgeon, I've been fortunate where I have not had to operate on many COVID patients, because I do certain operations that COVID does not cause. And to be really simple, COVID has a lot of different side effects, and we're finding out that it has a lot of different symptoms. So someone might come into the hospital right now with an infection in their chest, and they may or may not be COVID positive. The question is, does COVID actually cause that infection? Does it not cause that infection? The infection might be in their liver. Well, did COVID cause the infection in the liver, or did it not cause the infection in the liver? Because right now we're so focused on COVID that every diagnosis coming in is being compared with COVID, especially the patients that test positive for COVID, because we also know that there's a lot of asymptomatic carriers out there that have nothing wrong with them. So the truth is, what COVID has done is it's made everyone a little squeamish, because there's a lot of unanswered questions, understandably so. I'm sure you can have a whole show on whether or not the country should reopen versus everyone who wants to get back to work, but that's a whole different topic. But from a thoracic surgical standpoint, from a medical perspective, we are as careful as we can when we not only are interviewing and treating these patients, but it has changed a lot of the way we go about with our interactions. I do not go into a room anymore without proper protective equipment. I used to go in and shake hands. I don't shake hands. I put gloves on every single time. I do fist bumps, you know, now, or do a little shoulder, you know, touch elbows. When I'm speaking to somebody and they're not having a mask on, and a lot of my patients have coughs just because I'm there for respiratory issues, I am standing, you know, 6 feet away, making sure that I'm not in line. So there, it's what I think COVID has done is it's actually educating the population on how important hygiene is. Mm-hmm. I mean, we went to go see friends recently, and normally you'd give them a hug and give them a kiss on the cheek, and now that's just not happening, because why take the risk? You never know what's going to happen. And it really does affect the elderly and patients and people that are debilitated in a completely different way than it does for those of us that are healthier. Mm-hmm. It's just, that's a fact. So right now, I think COVID is an enigma that we're learning about every day. And I don't think that taking proper precautions is a bad idea. I just think that we need to be smart.
Be smart, right. Can you talk about the pneumonia aspect with that and what happens when one gets pneumonia?
So how about we relate this to smoking?
Okay.
When you inhale smoke into your lungs, you're creating an inflammatory response. By creating an inflammatory response, you're revving up all of the reaction that your lung has, if you will, that can lead to pneumonias and trapping bacteria, which can ultimately lead to what's called an empyema, which is an infection that takes place outside of the chest, which is usually what I have to clean up and clean out.
Okay.
Pneumonias start within the lung tissue itself. That's what COVID does. It's within the lung tissues itself.
Okay.
Right now, what we're seeing, COVID is not really creating that infection spreading outside of the lung, which is why, fortunately, I'm not having to operate on many people that have COVID. With that being said, the pneumonia that you or I might catch and not even know about it because we're healthy, we don't smoke, we exercise, we do all the right things, it comes and goes. Most people are exposed to things on a daily basis, but if you're healthy enough, it just kind of, your body is resilient. Your body takes care of it. So it's when you are doing things that you probably shouldn't be doing, like smoking, like drinking, doing drugs, vaping. Vaping was a huge topic before this whole COVID thing came into play. And I'll be honest with you, I have not seen as many vaping illness since COVID. And I don't know if that's because a lot of people are just more, you know, in tune with the fact that they need to be really careful of their lung health. But we saw a tremendous amount of people hospitalized who were vaping.
Wow.
So that's what happens whenever you have anything that's inhaled into your lungs that shouldn't be there. So smoking is the number one cause. It's bad for you. The only thing we should be breathing is clean air. I say it all the time. Okay. And I tell all my patients who smoke marijuana, because that's a huge topic as well.
Right.
So marijuana and lung health is a big, big deal, because a lot of people need it, meaning THC, to help them with chronic pain, anxiety. And I always tell them, if they can, to switch over to the edibles and the oils. Because anytime you inhale anything into your lungs, you're creating an inflammatory response. You're putting yourself more at risk for catching a pneumonia, which could ultimately lead to infection, hospitalization, and death. So anything you can do to help increase your lung health you should be doing.
So when I first moved to LA, I went to go jog around the Silver Lake Reservoir, and before I even made it there, I had to stop and I was convulsing. I was sick, and my friend said it's probably the air. It happened to him when he first arrived to LA because there was a lot of smog.
Sure.
So how do you go about living in a society or living in a city that has a lot of smog and maintain great lung health?
You probably don't, to be honest with you. I mean, there's a reason why some people move to a certain climate because they have severe asthma. I lived in New York City, and it used to gross me out when I would come home and take a shower and look at the dirt running off of my body. And I knew that all I was doing was just working.
Right.
So I'm not going to sit here and tell you walk around with a mask on all the time. But the truth is that if a toxic substance or if anything is affecting your lung health in such a way, then you have to figure out the options. Some people wear masks. Some people actually move. Obviously, that's not an option if you live and work in LA, but there's a reason why people, you know, work in a city and live in the suburbs.
Right.
You know, I mean, you know, since I moved out to California, I love looking at the stars every night, and I love, you know, where I live now. Yeah. It's, you know, a lot different than living in a big city.
And a lot of people that their homes are near highways, they have a higher percentage of lung cancer and things that are going on with their respiratory system as well. And I see that there are a lot of walls that are being built up to prevent, I guess, the smog from coming over as much.
It's one of those situations where it's very difficult to fix because you're not going to all of a sudden tell everybody, okay, stop driving your car and stop, you know, production of everything. You know, one of the examples I give was I unfortunately was the chief surgical resident on 9/11. I was at St. Vincent's Hospital and Medical Center in New York City, and we were the closest level one trauma center. So I was standing on 7th Avenue watching the towers fall with my own eyes.
Oh, my God.
Why do I bring that up? Because for weeks afterwards, we had to walk around. Literally, we walked around in the streets with masks because the air was just so thick. In that case, it's kind of like, you know, when I've gone down, you know, to L.A. to, you know, talk about the fires. You know, if you can look outside and you can see, you know, ash, you know, or anything falling from the sky, you know, chances are you might want to put a mask on because you don't want to breathe that stuff in, right?
Right. So, common sense.
You know, yeah, you know, but it's funny because up until recently, whenever we saw someone wearing a mask, we thought that they were either undergoing chemotherapy or they were a little cuckoo. And the truth is that now it's the norm, and it probably will be the new norm moving forward because it can't hurt. It cannot hurt to protect not only yourself, but more importantly, when you wear a mask, you're actually protecting everyone else because when you do cough or sneeze, you're not, you know, projecting anything that's inside of you onto any people or items or so on and so forth. So the questions you're asking, I really wish I had better answers for as far as, you know, smog and fog and pollution in major cities. But there's a reason why people, you know, go sit at the beach and breathe in that, you know, clean air and feel good. Mm-hmm. And then you go and you try to jog where you're talking about in LA and you start hacking up a lung, you know, just from trying to exercise. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it's you have to find that happy medium, I guess.
Do you deal with a lot of athletes and lung health?
So one of the best stories I love to tell is actually ex-football player. He played in the NFL and he had a lung mass, which ended up being a lung cancer, and I took it out. And he did great, left the hospital in a few days, but he told me that he would never stop smoking, never stop smoking, never stop smoking. And I kept getting on him and I kept getting on him. And then, you know, he was in the hospital. He didn't smoke for a few days. I said, dude, you're crazy. You know, you gotta stop smoking already. And then when I saw him at the 2-week follow-up, he thanked me not only for cutting out the cancer and, you know, ultimately saving his life, but for being so persistent. Because the first step in quitting smoking is you have to want to quit. You know, a lot of people just don't want to quit. You know, they've been doing it their whole life. But the people that want to quit, it's very difficult. It's nicotine's a very serious drug that a lot of people don't give enough credit to. That's why I applaud anyone, any agency, any person that is, you know, cutting off the vaping and the marketing to the teenagers and the young kids. Because, you know, just like cigarettes were, you know, glamorized and glorified, you know, back in the, you know, 30s, 40s, 50s, you know, the vaping with, you know, the flavors and you add some nicotine to it, you're turning, you know, all of these, not just children, teenagers and young adults into addicts.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So going back to this gentleman, he did quit. Finally, he was essentially scared straight because I told him that, you know, you got lung cancer in the first place. And what smoking does is it speeds up the process, if you will. So, you know, I may get lung cancer when I'm 95, but if I smoke, it'll, you know, rev it up to when I'm 70.
Right.
No.
So with the lung health with athletes, I was born in Colorado Springs and we had to move to Kansas. And the thing that everyone kept saying was, oh my gosh, you're going to run so much faster when you get to Kansas because I guess you're at a higher elevation in Colorado Springs. But isn't that more about lung capacity?
That and also oxygen carrying capacity. That's a whole different physiology lesson. But
okay.
the point is your body just gets acclimated to where you are. You know, just like if you lived up in the Himalaya Mountains versus living at sea level. But the truth is, no matter where you are, you really want clean air. And that's the bottom line.
Yeah.
You know, not inhaling anything but clean air.
Can you talk about third-hand smoke and how that affects us as well?
Absolutely. Did you say third-hand or second-hand?
Third.
No, I'll tell you. Because no one knows about third-hand unless they've read my book.
Okay. Yes, I said third-hand. Third-hand smoke.
So second-hand. If you live with a smoker and you have second-hand smoke, you have a 20% risk of getting lung cancer. We know that. Okay. What's actually interesting is most people do not know what third-hand smoke is. And third-hand smoke, the example I give is if you smoke a cigarette and you get it all over your walls or your car, the residue left behind, the chemical cocktail left behind is now exposed to whoever you go and pick up to give a ride, for example. So you smoke a cigarette in your car, right? You extinguish that cigarette. So the cigarette, first-hand smoke, that's gone. The second-hand smoke is gone. But the third-hand smoke is the chemical cocktail, the toxic cocktail that's left behind on the fabric in the car, the seats, you're inside. So you're exposed to it. And this is really important when you talk about children, because a lot of times people will go outside, they'll have a cigarette. All of the toxins will be on their clothes, on their hair, on their skin. And then, you know, their grandson or granddaughter comes and sits up on their leg and they read them a story. So now you are actually exposing that child to what's called third hand smoke.
Mm-hmm.
It happens a lot when, you know, when teachers or people will smoke in daycare centers when everyone goes out to play.
Right.
And it gets in the carpet, it gets in the wallpaper, it gets in the paint. And that's something that really, now we'll probably never have proper studies. There are a few out there, but the truth is, let's just talk about common sense. Common sense tells us that if you're going to expose your lungs to anything that is a carcinogen or that's cancer causing, then you're going to increase your risk of getting cancer. And you're also going to decrease your lung health. And you're also going to increase the risk of pneumonias and other lung problems.
Sounds great to me. And we can all get your book on Amazon and then your website. And your website is
ericpressermd.com. Okay. And there's some really good information on there. And yes, you can get my book on Amazon, and I have a bunch of videos on YouTube, which are fun to do, and they cover a lot of the topics we talked about today, in addition to a whole bunch of other stuff, everything from chronic cough to excessive sweating, like we spoke about earlier.
Can we talk about chronic cough for a second?
Sure.
What is that about?
There are many different reasons that can cause a cough. So if I sit here right now and I'm drinking a glass of water and I start coughing, well, obviously there's a cause and effect. It went down the wrong pipe, if you will, right? I'm not going to be overly concerned. But if it continues, and if I start to have symptoms of, you know, shortness of breath, or I become what's called dyspnea on exertion, which means that when I walk around, I'm getting, you know, dizzy, I'm getting lightheaded, I keep coughing, you should definitely see your doctor. You shouldn't ignore it, okay? There's a lot of different reasons why someone can have a cough, but you want to rule out the ones that you can treat. You want to rule out the ones that have a definite cause and effect. That could be something as simple as going to your doctor and getting a chest x-ray. In my opinion, as a thoracic surgeon, anyone who has had a chronic cough, which is a cough that's for, a month, if you will, you should get a CAT scan. You get a CAT scan of the chest, and that will allow us to see if there is anything that we need to evaluate or work up from a physician standpoint. Doesn't mean that every cough needs to be addressed by a thoracic surgeon. That's not what I'm saying. It means that you shouldn't ignore it, and you should definitely go and tell your doctor about it, because there's many different reasons. Everything from, you know, gastric, reflux can cause a cough. Mm. Lung cancer can cause a cough, and anything in between. Allergies can cause a cough. We can go on and on and on forever.
So with the COVID, just to go back to the COVID, because one of the symptoms is the dry cough and you can't get rid of it. How does that happen?
It's just the same inflammatory response that's caused by any kind of cough. And now, right now, because of COVID, if you are experiencing any kind of symptoms that are respiratory, then my recommendation would be, you know, go get tested. Go make sure that you don't have, you know, COVID-19 because of all the unknowns that are out there. But regardless of the COVID scare, the bottom line is that any cough that doesn't go away should be worked up. And you should tell your doctor about it. If you need to see a specialist about it, then they should point you in the right direction. But it's not something that should be ignored.
Dr. Presser, do you think that medicine now is getting better to where we're able to scan people earlier or have a scan, a yearly scan of our lungs, even if we're not smokers, have it be put in the proper care that we have yearly?
So that's a tough question, because there are people that will argue that it's not cost effective. And if you find something and it's worked up by the wrong types of people, then they will argue that there are unnecessary procedures that will be performed on lung nodules or findings that shouldn't even be addressed. And that's where it's a gray zone, because I have people that ask me, well, I don't fall into the category of lung cancer screening right now, but I grew up with secondhand smoke and my brother died of lung cancer.
Oh my goodness. Right.
Right. Cause you know, so there's a strong family history and they were exposed, but they don't fall into the category. And I tell them, if it will make you feel better, then let's get a CAT scan of your chest. And then I know that they're going to come to me and I know that I'm going to go over the images with them and I'm going to explain everything to them. And then you can kind of tailor their care based upon that. But right now, the truth is that we have a very difficult task of what's efficient and what's cost effective. And that's why the lung cancer screening, 55 to 77, asymptomatic, active smoker, this is a good start. It's a good start to raise awareness that the high risk group has to be focused on so that we can try to save people's lives.
So, Dr. Presser, again, we could get your book, An Empowering Guide to Lung Cancer, 6 Steps to Taking Charge of Your Care and Your Life. Is there anything that we didn't discuss that you think that our audience should know about lung cancer and taking charge of our lung health and care?
I think we covered just about everything from, lung health, to knowing what your options are, not just with, lung cancer, lung surgery, any kind of surgery, asking the right questions, trying to be an advocate for yourself and your loved ones. We have so much information out there right now. You kind of have to know how to, not just harness it, but also figure out, what's important. And I think that finding the right people to guide you is extremely important in the healthcare field and with anyone that deals with the doctor, because everyone knows someone who has had cancer or has cancer. I mean, that's the truth. It's not always lung cancer. Lung cancer is the number one cancer killer, and I'm glad that we're raising awareness.
Yes.
But like I said, it all falls into the category of lung health. And if you can't breathe, you're in a lot of trouble.
Right. What I love about my show is that I get to learn something by having guests like you, Dr. Presser, on. And I've learned so much. And I thank you for sharing your expertise and sharing your book with our listeners and having us be able to take charge of our life, our health. So thank you again. And Dr. Presser, let us know how we can find you, your website, Instagram, and Facebook.
DrPresserMD.com. A lot of YouTube videos out there. And as you mentioned before, my book is on Amazon. And it's been a pleasure. And I really, really appreciate your time. And I can't thank you enough for having me on your show.
Thank you, Dr. Presser. Again, go get his book, An Empowering Guide to Lung Cancer, 6 Steps to Taking Charge of Your Care and Your Life.
The Experience on 710 ESPN continues. Back to LaFern Cusack.
Dr. Presser is a tireless crusader for changing the dynamic of lung cancer treatment. Nothing will stop him. Dr. Presser knows he's on the right course, particularly as the facts and proof continue to mount in favor of prevention model for lung cancer. Equally telling is the growing number of more experienced surgeons who are adopting Dr. Presser's techniques. For more information, you can go to his website at ericpressermd.com, and he's on Instagram as Eric Presser MD and Facebook, Dr. Eric Presser MD. I'm LaFern Cusack, and this is 710 ESPN.
You've been listening to The Experience with LaFern Cusack, getting the residents of Los Angeles, Orange County, and all of Southern California closer to their community. It's The Experience with LaFern Cusack on 710 ESPN.